Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of reimaginedonline.org, sparking the evolution of education choice. On this episode, senior writer Lisa Bowie talks with Katie Switzer, a soon-to-be mother of five, who went all the way to the West Virginia Supreme Court to win the case for Hope scholarships in her state. Katie also runs her own grant-winning forest school that served close to 60 families last year alone.
So today we have with us Katie Switzer. Katie is a mother of four, soon to be five, and she is a historic figure in West Virginia, and she also runs her own forest school. So tell me a little about your background, your family, your own education, vocation, and all that good stuff.
So I grew up in upstate New York, so I'm from kind of like a suburban area of upstate New York originally. My main family is rural, which is what I really prefer. But I went to a public school in New York State for my education. And they're kind of like middle of the pack for New York, not one of the best ones, but pretty good. And I enjoyed my time there. I never thought to myself, gee, I hate public school and I never want my kids to go there. I had a really good experience at the school I was at. And then after school, I went and I got an engineering degree. So I'm a mechanical engineer. And as part of my career, I have moved and lived in seven different states. But West Virginia is the state I have been in the longest as an adult. We've lived here for 6 years now, and I really love West Virginia. This state is just so beautiful, and I love the people, and my kids love it too. So in my journey of engineer to full-time mom, it's been really interesting.
Why didn't you move to West Virginia, and what drew you all to the Mountain State?
So we moved to West Virginia for jobs, actually. My husband and I both had jobs at plants here in the Morgantown area. He got a position at an aluminum manufacturing plant down in Fairmont, and I got a position at a chemical manufacturer here in Morgantown. And so we moved here partially for jobs, but also because we both love the mountains. So we were looking for a place that had mountains. And we're both big nature lovers. We love to hike. We like to spend time with our kids and go camping outside. So we knew we were looking for an area like that. And we wanted to be a little bit closer to family. My family is still in New York and my in-laws are in Pennsylvania. So this was only like 2.5 hours away from my in-laws' house. And everything just kind of fell into place. And we moved here and we've really loved it here ever since.
Well, that sounds like a great environment for kids. Speaking of kids, tell me a little bit about each of your children.
So I have four kids right now. We're expecting our fifth in a couple of months. My oldest is seven. His name is Alexander, and he is a very much a classic oldest child. He's got kind of that engineering personality. He loves to solve problems, and he loves to be outside. My second child, her name is Ruth, and she's five, and she is very girly, which my mother would laugh at if she was still around, because I was not a girly child. So I've had to adjust to a lot of pink and frills. And my third child, his name is Warren, and he is three, and he is very boy. And then my fourth child, her name is Annie, and she's one. And she's turning two, actually, in a couple of days. And she is a to-be-determined personality, but nobody is running her over. And my favorite thing that my kids do here that just cracks me up every time they do it is we live up on top of a hill. Our neighborhood is like two mountains that have a valley in between that the road comes up. And my kids love to go out in the woods. And the neighborhood is built on an old coal mine. And one of the coal seams comes up to the surface on the side of the mountain. And there's lots of paths that kids have created over the years in the woods by our house. And my children will take their little Red Ryder wagon out into the woods and their shovels, and they will literally mine coal, fill their wagon with coal from the coal seam. They bring it back up to our house, and they have a bunch of bricks that they keep rearranging into different configurations for like a brick oven, and they'll burn the coal that they mine from the seam down the hill and then roast marshmallows and hot dogs on it. And my husband saw this meme not long ago that was like, you know, the kids like yearn for the mines because they're playing Minecraft now. So I like to joke that they're out there doing their Minecraft mining in Brandon. But they're very West Virginia kids. I can't think of anything more West Virginia than a bunch of kids going out to mine coal so they could roast hot dogs.
Yeah, only in West Virginia would that happen. So when you got here and had to put your children, at least some of them, in school, what did you learn about the schools where you are and what were your options at the time?
So when we first moved here, they really only had public schools if you wanted to have financial assistance from the state. There was no programs. And there's only a few private schools here in the area we're in. And most of them are Christian. So there's not a lot of secular options in the Morgantown area. And so we just weren't sure what we were going to do. I didn't know a lot about the schools we moved here. We just knew, like, our real estate agent told us, hey, you need to live in this school district because it's the best school district. As my kids got older, I started to listen a little bit more about what was going on in West Virginia education. And I realized that the educational opportunities here in West Virginia, and especially the outcomes, were not what I experienced as a kid in New York. So, for example, we live in the district of the third best high school in the state, Morgantown High School. And the school that I went to in New York, that's middle of the pack there, they're not even in, I think, the top 100 of the high schools in New York State. When you look at U.S. World and News Reports for their competency scores, they're 96% kids graduate with reading comprehension competency and 94 for math. So my husband, he went to school in rural Pennsylvania, an hour north of Pittsburgh, which is in a community that's kind of on the downswing. They used to be a really great thriving community during the oil boom, but now they're kind of not so great. His were in the 70s for the high school or the public school he would have gone to, except his mother pulled him out and put him in a private Christian school when he was in middle school, mostly because of bullying, not because of the educational. So then I was I'm going to check out what it is here in the county that I'm in West Virginia. What school would my kids go to? And I was shocked. I was shocked at the numbers. This is the third best high school in the state. And their reading competency graduating from school, which my understanding is that's the definition of literate, is only 64% of the kids graduating from the third best high school in the state. It's 64% reading competency, and it's 46% for math. So those scores are unbelievably low, especially considering that I did not go to a top high school in New York. I went to a public school in the middle. And so I realized, hey, this is probably going to be something that we want to think about, is do we really want to put our kids in these schools and have them be potentially graduating or getting moved up a grade without really passing and knowing the things that they need to know before they get moved up? And so around the time that my second child, my daughter was turning two, she was really having trouble speaking. And we started figuring out that she had some problems. So we were working with the early intervention program, and they helped us get a diagnosis for her of a speech disorder called apraxia of speech, which is a motor neurological disorder. It's pretty rare. It's 1 in 10,000 kids might have it. So in any given elementary school, you might have one kid that has apraxia. So it's hard to find support for it because normal speech delay techniques don't really work with it because it's a motor neurological issue. It's about building the motor connections between their brain where all the words are. They're stuck up there, and then they try to make the sounds with their mouth, and the motor memory isn't there to be able to replicate the sounds. And so when my daughter was about to turn three, when the pandemic started, she was really struggling because all of it was over Zoom. And part of apraxia is they actually help you to move your mouth and manipulate the muscles so you can feel what shape they should be like. And she went from having maybe 50 words down to 10 at that point, and she was almost three. So we switched over to a private speech therapist who specialized in apraxia. We were lucky that we lived in Morgantown because she is the only speech therapist in the state that specializes in apraxia and sees kids in person. There's a couple that try to do teletherapy. I have no idea how they can do that because it doesn't make any sense to me, my understanding of her disorder. But Her speech therapist made a massive difference in her ability to communicate. She went from 10 words and having regressed to having over 100 within like 2 months of starting with this therapist. But because she had apraxia, we knew there was going to be challenges when she entered the school age, because kids with apraxia have a hard time in classroom environments because other kids are talking over them. Kids that are her peer, they don't pause to let you speak and like gather your thoughts. And kids with apraxia really need to be able to do that because they're trying to like figure out how to get the words from their head down to their mouth. And so we started looking into other options and found, you know, for kids, private school is not really affordable to us. And most private schools still have, they don't have huge classroom sizes, but they still have pretty big classroom sizes. And we weren't sure what we were going to do. So at some point along this journey, around the time she was between 3 and 4, there was new legislation that went through in our state that allowed charter schools to open. And there was a charter school that was trying to start. Some teachers and parents had gotten together and said, we're going to start a charter school in Morgantown. And so my only interaction with charter schools has been my cousins that live in New York and now Pennsylvania have all used charter schools for their children. So I have like 7 second cousins, their kids that have all gone to charter schools and like just raved about them. But that's all I really knew. I didn't really understand how it worked. So there was like a public information session for this new charter school here in West Virginia. And I thought to myself, like, I'm going to go to that. I'll take Ruth. I'll see what it is. I can ask some questions and see like if it's going to be a good fit for her. So I was pretty naive about it. I really thought it was like just an information session where parents could ask questions. And when we showed up, there was a massive public teachers union rally outside this public information session that was like being run by some gubernatorial candidate. So we had to go through like a crowd of people with signs like, you can't go, we don't want charter school, we don't want you here, just to get in the building. And I signed up to ask questions because I thought like, I have a bunch of questions. Like I want to know their classroom sizes. I want to know if they're going to have like speech therapy on staff. I want to know all this stuff. And I signed up thinking that I was going to be able to ask the board questions. But it turned out that it was a like non-responsive. You were supposed to go up and speak at the board of these parents. They're just parents. Like none of these people are like from, they aren't business owners. They're like parents and teachers starting this charter school. And like you were supposed to speak at them, but you weren't expected, like they weren't allowed to respond and answer your questions. And so what I quickly realized was that this was not a public information session. This was a anti, we don't want you here thing, which was really shocking to me. I guess I just like never expected that. So I, you know, maybe 1 out of 10 out of like 40 people that were allowed to speak were a parent. And, you know, I had quickly realized I couldn't ask any questions. So I just went up and said like, hey, I'm a parent of a special needs child. You know, I came here wanting to ask questions and like, I'm shocked at what is going on here. Like, this is wild. I was really upset about it because I couldn't believe how mean they were. Like they were actively mean. Like these teachers had taken up all the speaking spots and they went up and they were like literally verbally abusing these parents and teachers who just wanted to start a school in the area. And so after witnessing that, it really turned me off of even considering the public school in our area. Cause I thought if these teachers and like whoever else had spoken feels so comfortable basically bullying all of these adults, like what are the classrooms like? So I started paying more attention to that. And there was a lot of headlines about like behavioral issues and bullying in classrooms. There was even one shortly after that where a teacher had gone into another teacher's classroom and interrupted the lesson to verbally abuse that teacher and get in an argument. And a high school student had to intervene to stop it. And I was like, and this is what's going on? So this had been like, all of this was kind of coming to a head for me because, you know, we had just a couple of months before been trying to transition my daughter out of birth to 3. And as part of that transition, we had like a meeting with the public school because they offer early pre-K to kids coming out of birth to 3. And part of our whole discussion was we have this team of people we've worked with for a couple of years. We really trust them. Like we want to know what they think and, you know, what services she could get. going over to the public pre-K program. And the lady that was on the school side of the administration in the meeting to help us coordinate, she was like, oh, no, you don't get to choose. So I said, what do you mean? And she goes, oh, no, it doesn't matter what your Birth to Three team thinks. You know, we do whatever evaluations we want to, including psychological evaluations. And you can either take it or leave it, but you can't say you just want speech and you don't want the other services we offer you. And I said, I'm the parent, and if I don't want my child seeing a psychologist at your school, like, that's not fair of you to say that then you won't offer her the speech therapy she needs. That's apparently our county is the only county in the state with that policy. But the way she said it to me was extremely disrespectful, not just of me, but of all these professionals that we'd worked with for 2 or 3 years with my daughter, that they knew her well, they had really helped her, and she didn't want to hear anything that they had to say or us. It was like, we own your daughter when she's in this program. And I got the feeling about, this is weird. And then I discovered that if you enroll your three-year-old in their preschool program, they're now subject to compulsory schooling requirements. So they take attendance and they'll send a truancy officer after you if your child is absent too much to say, go to speech therapy appointments, and you don't have it documented and stuff. And I said, that's just too much for our family with a three-year-old, and I couldn't do it. So we decided to not use those services. But just looking at the educational system as a whole, performance was bad, communication was bad, attitude towards parents was horrible, and the bullying. I was like, why would I put my kid, my special needs kid, in this situation where she's likely not going to thrive? So that was kind of like the beginning of us going, okay, we got to figure out other options. And around that time, the Hope Scholarship started to be like a thing they were talking about in the legislature. You know, I'd never heard of an ESA program. I think it's very new. I don't think states have really had it up until like maybe 10 or 5 years ago. And when I realized what it was and that I could get funding that would pay for my daughter's speech therapy, we now know that she's dyslexic, so she needs dyslexia tutoring and special programs for that. And that we could get that money, part of the funding that she would get from the state for even if she went to public school, I was like, well, yeah, that sounds amazing. You know, I can tailor my daughter's education for her and not inconvenience the school. She can go to a specialist speech therapist, because the school speech therapists aren't going to know about apraxia. It's such a rare thing. It wouldn't make any financial sense for them to train all of their speech therapists in that. I couldn't reasonably expect that. And so that's what we decided we were going to try to pursue, was we really like to see this legislation go through so that kids like my daughter that need flexible education options can have them. And that program covers like private school tuition. You can use it for speech therapy, occupational therapy. You can use it for homeschool curriculum or co-ops. There's a lot of flexibility with it. So that program did get passed through the legislature. And something that I really liked about how they structured it was that it was kind of built not to be penalizing to the public school that my child was like would have accessed. We get less than half of the funding that the public school would have gotten for her because we only get the state portion. So they continue to receive the federal, local, and special needs funding that she would have received. I think they get the special needs, but I know they get the federal and local funding. They still have a higher funding per pupil, even if my daughter has left, which is really nice because we get some funding and the public school gets some funding and they're able to spend more per pupil and theoretically improve the quality of the education for the kids who stay in the public school.
So was this the first time you got active politically?
Yes. Never before have I been involved in anything like this. I just said, like, listen, this is really important to me and this could make like a huge life-changing difference in my daughter and her peers in the school. So when it got kind of serious was after it passed, there were some people that said, we're going to stop this program. We don't want people to have access to this. And they did. They filed in court and put an injunction on it.
I understand the judge just unilaterally made a decision and just shut down the whole program.
It was worse than that because I think we went through 3 judges before her who recused themselves and refused to make any decision on the case. So it took like 6 months, maybe longer, to go through all of those judges that recused themselves before it finally made it to this judge. And this judge put the injunction on, and she has public record of having received a couple, like, thousands of dollars in funding from teachers unions for reelection campaign. So, like, she had received thousands of dollars in donations from teachers unions, and then she didn't recuse herself and just unilaterally shut down the program and put an injunction on it. And she did that, by the way, a month before the funds were supposed to be funded. So, like, all of these families had been accepted. They were planning on this funding. They believed that they were going to receive it. And they just got their educational plans were just thrown out the window. It was horrible. And then it just sat there in court for a long time. Like, we were waiting for appeals and things like that. And so we were fortunate because the Institute for Justice had asked us around the time that the original lawsuit against To Stop It was filed, if we would represent Ruth and our family and help to defend this program for other families in West Virginia. And we agreed to do that. But we couldn't make it to the original court hearing because our third child was having heart surgery that day. So my son was in heart surgery and just getting out when I got the call that said they put the injunction in and that we had lost funding, and it was like an indefinite limbo. So that was a really tough day for our family because we had made all these plans and we couldn't go forward with them.
Yeah, I saw all of the emails, the things that were written on the Cardinal Institute's website, and they were just heartbreaking. Tell me a little bit about the mood with all these families. What was going on in town?
It was just chaos. Like, it was total chaos. Like, all of these families that we knew that were planning on using it in our own, nobody knew, like, how soon can we get in court to appeal this? You know, is it possible we'll get back funding? You know, when it finally, because we were confident we were going to get the program back because we knew that this judge was not unbiased. We knew that this program was constitutional. And so we knew that the decision was based on politics and not on law. And it was just a question of how soon could we get into court. We really believed that. Like, that was our stance from the whole thing. I would never have supported something that I didn't think was legal. So it was just like there was all these questions of what if we get to court and the injunction gets thrown out? And then do we get the funding for the fall for the months that we missed? Can we enroll our children in private school and then pay them later using the funding? These parents had like a lot of really good questions and there was no answers because nobody knew. There was no way to know. And also, like, the Treasury had to stop their whole implementation of the program. So they couldn't answer questions. They couldn't like start to get the portal up and running, work on the marketplace and like bring in new providers. Like, it was totally frozen. So like all the program development was stopped too, which came into play after the court decision because they had to figure out how to do all that and do it in a very short period of time. So eventually we made it all the way to the Supreme Court of West Virginia with our appeal. And so my daughter got to go with us to the Supreme Court and listen to the Institute for Justice argue for her rights to have a quality education that fits her needs. And it was great. It was such a great experience for her. And for me, I had never seen or done anything like that. I've never been to court before. Like, it was really, to go to the Supreme Court for your first time is like really shocking. It's very fancy. And they like immediately saw my five-year-old and were like targeting her. Like, don't talk, you know, you can't do this. They wanted to really keep it a respectful environment. So it was very, it was very interesting. But I think it was either the next day or the day after, they said, our attorney said, oh, it might take a few weeks before we get a ruling. And like literally a day or two later, our attorney called us and said, we won. You know, we won. The injunction's lifted and the program's going to come back. And it was just, it was an incredible moment to know that like we had been a part of helping this program be in West Virginia and giving all these kids new opportunities. Because my dream is not to get rid of public schools. Like, I don't think that's the answer. I think the answer is just to change the system so that we can give public schools like flexibility so that they don't have to be these big one-size-fits-all classrooms and these huge buildings and kids that have ADHD and don't fit in can, you know, get lost because they don't want to deal with them Or, you know, if a kid is having social issues and dealing with a bully, there's nowhere for them to go because they can't switch classrooms. Like, I want to see public schools that are flexible and different, like where there's smaller schools that are special, you know, that offer different types of education and classrooms for different types of kids that need that, so that a kid can cross their zip code lines. If they're in a classroom where they have a bully and that's the only thing that's not working for them, but that's enough to destroy a lot of kids' enjoyment of going to school and learning, then they can just go to a school that's 2 miles down the road outside their zip code assigned school district and thrive there. And we should have that kind of adaptability and flexibility for public schools. And HOPE offers that because they allow public schools and encourage public schools to be providers for HOPE. And it's not a replacement.
So what did you do with Alexander during this time? Because he was school age.
He was. And Ruth, actually, she tested into early entry kindergarten. So she was HOPE eligible too. So Alexander, he had already been applied and accepted for HOPE when they put the injunction in. And I, having our family be involved in the lawsuit, I really wanted my kids to keep their eligibility. And there was questions about that. Like, if a kid gets homeschooled this fall while there's an injunction and then the injunction is listed, will this kid still be eligible because they're not in public school for 45 days, which is one of the requirements for eligibility. You had to be entering kindergarten or have attended public school for 45 days. So we decided to enroll our children in the charter school that had just opened here in Morgantown. And our original plan had been to have them there as a partial day because they were offering a dyslexia reading program that I wanted my daughter to attend in the mornings. But they did not offer that anymore because of the HOPE injunction. They were only offering that because of the HOPE scholarship. So both of my kids got enrolled there full time. And that was, I mean, we had good and bad experiences there, but it was hard on my daughter because it was a full day in a classroom. And she had a hard time adjusting to that. It was overwhelming for her because her peers are all talking and she can't necessarily keep up. And because the HOPE scholarship went away, and maybe for other reasons, I'm not sure, the dyslexia reading program never really got off the ground. So like the reason why we had been excited to put her there, at least part-time, it just, they weren't able to get it going because they're a new school too. But they retained their eligibility. Now, it turned out when they lifted the injunction that they like basically froze everyone's eligibility and said, you can still, you're good. And they even back paid the funding for people who had committed to private school or had bought curriculum. They refunded and reimbursed people for that, which was really, really generous of the state. And I think they really went above and beyond to do the right thing for these families. But for us, it was hard because we had to drive our kids 30 minutes each way, more than that some days because of the traffic, to go to school because they didn't have public transportation. And I didn't want to enroll them at the local public school because, frankly, after I saw the bullying that they did to the teachers, I felt that my kids would be targeted by them because they would know that we were involved in this lawsuit and that they wouldn't treat my children, you know, with the kindness that they might treat other children who weren't so involved. It was really scary to have that lawsuit hanging out there, having never done something like that and knowing I was putting my neck out there. I just didn't feel comfortable putting them in our local school. But we have HOPE now, and it's been really great the last couple of months being able to use that funding. Both of my older kids are attending a co-op 2 days a week down the road from our house. It's 5 minutes from our house. And it's a co-op that's set up for flexibility for kids. So they don't sit down at a desk all day. They do a lot of narration and reading aloud, which has been great for my daughter because I feel like it helps her to feel included and comfortable because it's not all writing work. And kids that have dyslexia, they really need auditory learning. It's difficult for them to sit and read. So that program has been really excellent. And they have small classroom sizes, so the number of kids is not so overwhelming for her. And my oldest has really thrived there too. So we're really grateful to have that funding. And it's helped us with, we use that to pay for her dyslexia tutoring. And we could use it for her speech therapy too. But because we're doing the co-op and the dyslexia, it's not quite enough to cover everything. but it's a huge amount that helps us enormously.
And you get a scholarship per child. So it's not like they have to share the $4,600.
Yeah. And because we attended the school in the fall, we only got half of the funding for the spring. Mm-hmm. So, you know, each of my children got half of $4,300 towards theirs, which for my oldest child who doesn't have any special needs, that's adequate. But for my daughter who needs all of these additional services, she could use a little bit more so that we could pay for her speech therapy and those things. But, you know, when she was at the public charter school, I was paying for those services on top of driving her to charter school every day because they didn't have a speech therapist there and they were not offering the dyslexia tutoring because they were just trying to figure everything out. So we ended up having to pay for that anyway, which was frustrating at times.
How are things going now that Hope is getting off the ground?
It's good. The program itself has had some roadblocks. I mean, because the injunction really threw them for a loop, but the program itself has been amazing. Like there's some really great curriculums out there. Like my oldest, he really benefits from a certain type of math. And we were able to just like go on there, buy the curriculum for him and have it show up at our house a week later. And like having that kind of accessibility where I don't have to sit there and go, can we afford this in our budget? And like, you know, really have to stress about it has been amazing. And both of my kids have really been thriving, having the flexibility of doing a home education, but also having like the social and for me, the homeschool curriculum guidance of going to the co-op 2 days a week, you know, because they provide support for parents too. So it's not just like, oh, I drop my kids off and it's like babysitting. No, they help us with curriculum and continuing the things that they're doing at school at home so that there's continuity. And they help us to be flexible for my daughter. Like her reading program is different than my son's because of her dyslexia. She can't do phonics. Kids with dyslexia, phonics is like very difficult for them. So we're doing what they call an Orton-Gillingham program, which is not common in a public school, but is amazing for kids like Ruth. And so like having that at home and being able to do that. And it's like if a kid is having a bad day or they like wake up in the morning and they just can't do like certain complicated things, having the flexibility to say, let's take a break and we'll work on this afternoon makes a huge difference in my kids' attitude towards school. Like Ruth would cry every day when I dropped her off at the charter school. And she would like sit in her teacher's lap and be disruptive in the classroom because she was so overwhelmed. She didn't know how to like handle the communication. Whereas at home, we can just focus on the learning. And if she's not in the right mindset to learn, I don't have 20 other kids that have to also be gone through those. And I don't have compulsory schooling requirements where like I have to hit a certain number of hours a day or whatever it is that they have to do. I can just say, we'll take a break and we'll come back to it later this afternoon or tomorrow. And it keeps her attitude towards learning way more positive than it was when she was forced to kind of like do the same thing every day. I mean, I can't imagine being a teacher and having to try to fit an education to 20 kids that all have different learning styles. They all have different needs. They all are at different levels. I mean, it's hard enough for me with like two at home that are, you know, one is 7 and one is 5 and they have different needs. And I can't imagine being a teacher. And like, they're seriously heroes.
Yeah, I think some of them deserve a medal too. Speaking of educators, with all you've been doing, as if it wasn't enough, you started your own school. So tell me about that.
Yeah. So about 2 years ago, actually, like at the beginning of the pandemic, we really wanted our kids to have access to outdoor learning because our kids love to hike. They love to camp. They love to be outside. And when I was first home with my kids, my oldest two, when they were little, I would get like really overwhelmed at times. And I had a friend who told me once, put them in water or take them outside. And that was like such an incredible piece of advice that is way overlooked because she was right. Anytime that you change your environment and you bring them outside, you're having a bad day, right? Your kids are fussing, they're screaming, it's whatever. You just go outside and go for a walk and they're like different kids. And so I wanted my kids to have access to like a formal program to do learning outside because I had learned that for a lot of kids, it's really effective and it's fun. So I had a friend who ran a forest school out in Oregon at the time. She now lives in Pennsylvania. And I asked her, I was like, how did you start this forest school? You know, like, what is this? How does it work? And she now sells a homeschooling curriculum, but she gave me her curriculum for forest school. And I just like asked a bunch of friends, hey, are you guys interested in doing this? I'm going to get this curriculum and then I'm going to start running this. And I got an enormous amount of people that were like, yeah, I would love to do that. You know, whatever. And like anything else, you start it and then like not all those people are going to come join. But it was amazing the first fall we did it. So it was like the fall of 2020, we started this program. And the first session that I did was Saturday mornings and we had 13 families. And because we have a large family, we set it up so like when somebody pays, they pay one fee for the first kid and then just a little bit after that to pay for like supplies for each additional child, because we wanted to make it really accessible and affordable. And to continue that, we decided to not make it a drop-off program because I have never run a daycare. I don't know anything about DHHR rules or summer camps. So I thought, well, I'm just going to make it easy and I'm going to make it like a family program. So the parents bring their kids, they bring siblings, and we're going to go do a hike together and we're going to do forest school activities. And because I have some background in Montessori, I thought, well, let's just make it that style where older siblings that come can be mentors. And I'll teach them how to work with the younger kids on hikes and like how to facilitate activities and just make it like a really enjoyable time for everybody, regardless of age. So that first fall, we did like different locations each week. We would go out and do a different hike. And then I matched curriculum activities to the location and the weather and the season that we were in to try to kind of use as much natural materials as we can instead of, you know, we're not just going out into the city park and using pipe cleaners and ribbons to make things. We're going out in the woods and picking up acorns so that we can make something for like acorn whistles, or we're picking up fall leaves and making leaf crowns. We're working with the kids to try to use what's around them and giving them this like opportunity to just run around and climb on rocks and balance on logs and play and just really enjoy it. And so it's a nice opportunity too to mentor parents on how to step back and just let their kids learn the limits of their body in a safe environment. And like I call it supervised risk taking of like, you know, how to do that without hovering and like when to tell your child to stop versus when to let them challenge themselves. So it's been really fun. Last year, we served close to 60 families and 100 kids. So we now run sessions 2 days a week. There are like 2-hour sessions in the morning from 9:30 to 11:30 at a different location every week. And this spring, we're already more than half full for the spring session that starts in about 3 weeks. So I'm really excited to see how it goes. But I have loved running that school. It was such a stretch for me at first, being an engineer. Like, I'm not a teacher. I don't have like exemplary social skills. And I was terrified that people were going to hate it, because in order to run the program, you have to pay for insurance and you have to, you know, pay for materials. You can't just do it for free. It doesn't work that way. So I had to charge people, and that was scary. But now, like, I feel like it's been such a building experience for me personally to figure out, like, how do I manage interpersonal conflicts between parents or families? And how do I keep these kids engaged? And how do I pick activities that are going to interest the pack of boys in the Thursday group? And it makes it really fun. It's like a puzzle. It's like a social puzzle I have to put together and then execute. So I've learned to love the social challenge of forest school too.
Now, I understand you got some help. How did you learn about the Vila Education Fund and how did they help you?
So the Cardinal Institute is the same organization who told me about Hope Scholarship and helped connect us with Institute for Justice. They told me about the Vila Educational Fund, where they do grants. So I was able to apply for a grant for them. And I won a $10,000 grant last summer to help with building up the forest school program. And, you know, we were able to buy a GoPro to help document our forest school sessions. And I used it to purchase some training. And then also I got some tools that the kids can use, like hand drills and saws for cutting up different things and building things out in the woods. It's really fun.
So are you going to get certified as a HOPE scholarship provider also?
I don't think so, mostly because our program serves kids 3 to 7. So we're a little bit younger than the HOPE scholarship program, and we are small. You know, I can only handle about 15 families in each session. Any more than that, and it just gets to be too big, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to be a HOPE provider, especially because we try to keep it very affordable.
What advice would you have for someone who is considering starting their own program or their own school?
So the biggest thing, I think, is just having an understanding of how to not just have like curriculum, because I think a lot of people try to start a school and they focus purely on curriculum, but you have to be able to market it. You have to have the ability to communicate with other people to tell them what you're really giving them. Because I'm not giving them a guided hike or like, you know, activities to do in the woods. I'm giving them a framework to use with their kids for the rest of their children's childhood to enjoy time with them and to see how to use nature to incorporate education. And I think that is an important distinction that a lot of teachers struggle with, to see like that big picture and how to present that to parents. I would also like to say start small, because like our ultimate dream here is to have outdoor classrooms and a curriculum for homeschool and a drop-off program. But by starting it as a family forest school and not trying to bite off a huge chunk of how do I handle drop-off and do I do background checks and hire people and reliable, you know, employees and things like that, just starting the program in a chunk that I could bite off and make it accessible and easy for me to run has made it more successful because it's not overwhelming. And I would like to see more business owners be able to do that so that they can build up to, you know, what their big goal is.
Well, this is great. I just want to thank you for coming on with me and sharing your story. It's amazing. You've done it all. You've been an activist, an advocate, and a scholarship parent, and an entrepreneur. So you, the whole package.
I don't know. I'm trying, though. I'm just like anybody else. You just do one step at a time. But I'm really proud of that we were able to help make HOPE Scholarship available to everybody. And I'm really proud of my kids and all the work that we've done together. So I really appreciate the opportunity to come on here and talk about the crazy journey that my family has been through in the last 3 years.